Hello, I'm Claire Wright, Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe University. Welcome to Literary La Trobe, a podcast showcasing the writing and research of La Trobe University's staff, students, adjuncts and alumni. The recording you're about to hear was recorded on Thursday, the 31st of July, 2025, at the Bendigo Library on the unceded country of the Djadjawarong and Tungurung people of the Kulin Nation. The Sandhurst Mechanics Institute opened in 1854 and for more than 50 years held the largest book collection in Bendigo. In this lively conversation, Dr. Claire Knowles and Dr. Alexis Harley explore what the Mechanics Institute reveals about the history of reading and writing in the goldfields. From handwritten marginalia to the suspiciously pristine pages of a 150-year-old book of verse, and from complex, ambitious literature to 1860s advertising jingles, this session uncovers the archival clues and newspaper records that tell us what readers and writers were up to during this formative stage of Bendigo's history. The speakers are Dr. Claire Knowles, who has published three books on Romantic era poetry and is the former president of the Romantic Studies Association of Australasia, joined by Dr. Alexis Harley, a lecturer at La Trobe University who researches the intersections of 19th century literature and the history of science in colonial contexts. I hope you enjoy.
This Discovering History seminar series is a partnership between La Trobe University, the Bendigo Regional Archive Centre, and also the Goldfields Library. And so it's really great to welcome you all here today. And it's especially great today that we have a very close connection to Bendigo and Bendigo's history. And as our great speakers will explain today, that connection. But they'll be speaking today in connection with a collection that we hold at the La Trobe Bendigo campus at our library there. So if anyone is local to Bendigo, well, please do come and have a look at the La Trobe University Library and you can actually see the collection. But I'm sure my colleagues today will explain a little bit more. I'm not going to give a big introduction. These are great colleagues, great friends of mine. They have assured me that they will introduce themselves, but it is a pleasure to welcome to Bendigo Associate Professor Claire Knowles and Dr. Alexis Harley. And I'm just going to hand over to you guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Emma. So as Associate Professor Robertson just said, we are Alexis Harley and Claire Knowles, and we're two parts of a trio of literary historians. Which might be a bit of a strange concept to you, but we're lodged in an English program at La Trobe University, but we work on the history of literature. And with our jet-setting colleague, ARC Future Fellow Tom Ford, who couldn't be here tonight, we've been working over the past year with the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute Library Archive to reconstruct the literary history of 19th century Bendigo. And we are delighted to be here this evening to tell you a bit about our findings. I want to reiterate Emma's acknowledgement that we're meeting on Djadjawarong and Tungurung country and pay our respects to all Indigenous people, particularly acknowledging as we talk about the literary history of this region that people have been making and telling stories on this land for thousands of years. And we also have a few important words of thanks. Firstly, to all of you who are here and on Zoom, it takes a pretty doughty person to venture out at night in the middle of winter to hear a talk from a couple of literary historians about 19th century goldfields literature. So thank you very much for being here. It's much appreciated. Thanks to Associate Professor Emma Robertson of La Trobe History and the wonderful people of the Goldfields Library Corporation, Geordie here, for organising this event. It's great to be giving this talk in the Bendigo Library. As you'll hear, this research comes out of our love for libraries and our sense of libraries not only as repositories of culture but as places that make and shape culture. And we'll be talking at length about the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute Library and its surviving archive. Do I have a... I can't remember where my slides are. No, I'm not there yet. Our research also owes a lot to the Haywood Library at La Trobe, where the, as Emma said, the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute Library Archive is now housed, to the State Library of Victoria and to the National Library of Australia. As you'll see on the slide, We also want to thank the Bendigo Tertiary Education Anniversary Foundation and its generous benefactors for sponsoring, not a minute too soon, a rescue operation of the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute Library collection. It was housed in this beautiful reading room, the reading room of the old Sandhurst Mechanics Institute Library. And this historically significant archive of 19th century reading matter was being abused by pigeons in the most unspeakable ways. It is now, thanks to the Bendigo Tertiary Education Anniversary donors and our colleagues at the Haywood Library at Bendigo La Trobe, housed instead in these state-of-the-art glass cabinets. And you can go and peruse the collection. And digitisation of the collection is also underway, which means it's going to be available to a community of global researchers. So we've been fortunate enough to spend the past year with this archive, supported by the Tertiary Education Anniversary Foundation, handling some of the books that the early colonists of Sandhurst / Bendigo were also handling and reading, sometimes annotating, no doubt to the annoyance of 19th century librarians, but to our great delight because we get to see some of how people were thinking as they were reading. These days, of course, Bendigo has its own rich literary culture, and I feel a bit Coles to Newcastle in saying that to you. I'm sure you know this. There's the excellent, this is a bit of a shameless plug, the excellent Bendigo Writers Festival, which is going to be on in just a fortnight. There are some very fine bookshops. There's this fabulous library. You can study literature and creative writing at school and university without leaving the city. And there is even, at this very minute, an extracurricular free poetry workshop running up on Flora Hill by our colleague, Dr. Gregory Marks, who I invited to come here to hear about poetry in 19th century Bendigo. And he said, oh, actually, I'm going to be running a poetry workshop at exactly that time in Bendigo. So it turns out that this kind of sociable literary culture that you know so well dates back to within the very first decade of the Bendigo Gold Rush. Literary activity, the reading and writing and discussing of literature, manifested in various centres in Bendigo's 19th century community, in public novel readings, poetry recitals. We're going to be talking tonight about what this 19th century goldfields literary culture looked like, what people were reading and writing and talking about, and what we think was behind the attempted institutionalisation of literary culture through organisations like the Mechanics Institute and Free Library, and which was founded in 1854, as you perhaps know, and this fine publication, which some of you may still know and regard with varying degrees of affection as the Addy. Okay, I'm going to hand over to Claire.
Yeah, sorry, we've got a very strange system of kind of splitting this paper, but anyway. So I'm just going to give a little bit of I'm too naturally loud for one of those things. I'm just going to give a little bit of a background on what was going on in Bendigo at the time that the Mechanics Institute was kind of developed. So, and some of this history will be very familiar to many of the people in the room, no doubt. So the discovery of gold in 1850 in Victoria sparked a series of extraordinarily rapid social and economic transformations in the colony, newly independent of New South Wales from 1851. Within 3 years, Victoria's settler population grew more than threefold, from around 75,000 in 1851 to 240,000 in 1854, then doubled again to reach more than 500,000 by 1861. This massive influx of immigrants was drawn not only from Britain and its imperial possessions, as had previously been the case for almost all settlers to Australian colonies, but also from a much wider range of diverse lands, from continental Europe, Germans, Italians, French, Scandinavians, Eastern Europeans, many of whom were in effective exile following the failed revolutions of 1848, Americans travelling across the Pacific from the gold rushes of California, Chinese people from Guangdong, Fujian and other southeastern provinces destabilised by Western incursions and the Taiping Rebellion, and other hopeful diggers drawn from all corners of the globe by the promise of gold and its associated economic boom. To many observers at the time, the socially destabilizing effects of the gold rush, and you're my slide lady, could not be exaggerated. Its disruptions, commented Anthony Trollope, are those of an earthquake. Gold fever created instant canvas cities and overnight communities, polyglot and cosmopolitan, culturally heterogeneous and politically turbulent. Predominantly young and male and often disconnected from domestic concerns and family ties, gold seekers were seen to constitute an undisciplined and troublingly itinerant population. The sudden riches that appeared to be on offer presented an exaggerated version of capitalist development, eroding established hierarchies of wealth and power. Melbourne's first Anglican bishop, Charles Perry, deplored the great variety of nations and races and the almost total want of social intercourse of the people with one another. Perry's wife, Frances Perry, she of the hospital, meanwhile wrote of gold as that hateful, fearful, baneful subject. All wise and good men look with great alarm on this new feature in our history. Victorian gold rush society seemed to present a delirious and threatening version of intensified modernity. So it's in this context that we turn to an unlikely civic amenity of the Victorian goldfields, poetry, to examine its recruitment as a tool for shaping the goldfields' chaotic environment and stabilising its transient population. So that's what we kind of argue that the Mechanics Institute played a role in doing. And also poetry more generally. Our focus, of course, is on the region gazetted as Sandhurst from 1853 to 1891, before the long-running popular preference for Bendigo prevailed, where alluvial gold first became apparent to colonial prospectors in 1851. Within months of this news, 20,000 diggers had arrived in Bendigo. Two decades later, some 12,000 mining companies were working the quartz reef of Sandhurst, at the time the highest yielding goldfield in the world. Writing about the companies in 1871, our bearded friend Trollope singled out 20 or so company names that took his fancy. There were the anticipated new chum and old chum companies, but there were also considerations named, for instance, the Sons of Freedom, an allusion to Henry Bishop's popular ballad of 1816, the Sir Walter Scott, the Lord Byron, symptoms of the reach of British poetic culture. And I think that's kind of interesting, actually, really interesting. Amongst the dirty, dangerous excavations and the seemingly endless hustling, the mining capitalists' occasional invocation of poetry or of a poetic figure sought, we think, to romanticise the frantic hacking and crushing of Bendigo quartz, or to imagine how the hell-for-leather quest for gold might ultimately yield some more respectable, pro-social and more than monetary outcome. An important function for literary culture on the goldfields, we're suggesting, was to civilise or at least imply civility. The year that Trollope noted the names of Byron, Scott and Bishop on the Sandhurst Company register, the Bendigo Caledonian Society used the voluminous proceeds from its dramatic rendition of Rob Roy to fund an annual Waverley Prize for the best high school essay on Walter Scott, the author, of course, of the original Rob Roy. Celebrity authors like Scott provided conduits through which colonial populations could sluice their ethnic nostalgia, but they also became channels for activities signalling colonial permanence. I believe, for instance, that the Waverley Prize, endowed in 1871, thanks to the deep pockets of Bendigo's theatregoers, persists in only slightly modified form to this day, more than 150 years later.
Thank you. There's some great gossip about the Waverley Prize. Is anyone aware of the Waverley Essay Prize? It's a high school essay prize that's been around in Bendigo for 150 years and. There was a plagiarist who was outed in the Bendigo Advertiser in the late 19th century. Anyway, so exciting. as you can tell, we're quite thick into this history. So Walter Scott, the vastly popular Walter Scott, was a poet, but he was almost certainly better known by the people of 19th century Bendigo for novels like Waverley, like Rob Roy, like perhaps Ivanhoe, than for his poems. But we're turning today to the uses to which poetry specifically was put in this 19th century colonial settlement or unsettlement, as it might have been more appropriately described in the 1850s. Reading, writing, publishing, owning, talking about, or simply alluding to poetry were, of course, just some of the ways in which people practiced literary culture in 19th century Bendigo. But they weren't being singled out, we think, because of poetry's particular associations in this period gave it distinctive functions in redirecting colonists' experience of accelerated dislocation from the past, from homelands, from social order, and towards an idea of permanence and perhaps respectability. And some of these associations are codified by poet and literary theorist Matthew Arnold. Arnold was the godfather of Victorian era poetry, really, the first person to lecture on poetry at Oxford in English rather than Latin. Three of his books were housed in the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute, we've discovered. In 1880, he wrote, "The future of poetry is immense because in poetry, where it is worthy of its higher destinies, our race, as time goes on, will find an ever surer and surer stay." Poetry for Arnold was a mechanism for social progress, but also, in his view, the surest measure of how progressed a society was. While social progress mattered to Arnold's middle-class readers in Victorian England, era England, it perhaps mattered still more in a rapidly growing and still very young colonial city like Bendigo. Arnold's call for an apprehension of poetry's higher uses and higher destinies speaks to a widespread intuition at this time that poetry facilitated civic evolution. And this may have owed something to Percy Bysshe Shelley's pronouncement of 1821 that poets were the unacknowledged legislators of the world. Shelley had, of course, been a major romantic poet, but the fact that the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute Library held three books about and only one by Percy Shelley, and this is a photo of one of the books in the library archive about Shelley, reflects how important he was as a symbol. He was the author of The Necessity of Atheism. He was a liberal. He was a humanitarian. He was a heroic figure for progress. So people were interested in him as a poet, even if they weren't particularly wanting to read his poems. Along with poets like Thomas More and Robert Burns, some of you might recognise this bust from the Bendigo Art Museum, who were put to work as representatives of Irish and Scottish immigrant populations. A figure like Shelley, renovated by his Victorian era biographers as a figurehead for democracy and humanitarianism, provided the colonists of Sandhurst with a symbol of respectability. I mean, bizarrely, if you know anything about Shelley, and good order, also bizarrely, liberalism, humanism, sensibility. What the idea of poetry and the poet offered here was importantly different from, but obviously continuous with, the affordances of literary culture more generally. The catalogues of the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute and Free Library, which survive, and they're absolute troves of information about how the library was developing, what people were reading, along with advertisements of Goldfield's book merchants, make clear that novels were far and away the most popular recreational reading material in Bendigo from its population boom in the 1850s on. Indeed, to some extent, the popularity of the novel perhaps contributed to the special status of at least some forms of poetry. One patron of the Mechanics Institute took to the suggestions book for members in 1875 to decry the library committee's enthusiasm for supplying its members with trashy novels. A couple of years later, another member suggested this. I'm not sure if you can read this, but they've suggested that a copy of D.G. Rossetti's, Dante Gabriel's Rossetti's poems be procured. This member said, "It is a work which no literary institute should be without and has provoked the profoundest interest in all admirers of lyric poetry." We can also see on this slide, if you can decode it, quite a campaign in the members' suggestions book to promote the purchasing of a copy of the works of John Keats. I just want to spend a moment with this suggestions book for members before getting back to poetry, because it's such a delicious archive of 1870s Bendigonian decorum. It was intended to be a place where members could recommend book purchases to the library committee, but it very rapidly devolved into being a place where members could complain about each other. So you can see on this slide, I would suggest that the officers of the Institute should take immediate steps to suppress the whistling of the juveniles in the chess room, and am only surprised that attention should have to be called thereto. And this one is our absolute favourite. I would respectfully beg leave to suggest the advisability of some insecticide being occasionally distributed over floor of reading room, which would cause fleas to remain on the persons they come in company with, and disincline said fleas to hop about the floor and from thence onto a person who previously had none about them and do not desire their company. P.S. Fleas are inimical to intellectual culture, frustrate study, and as a consequence, the design of the Institute. This is A-grade Karening, as the kids say, but it also reflects the timbre of the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute as a social space, a place where people went in search of a kind of decorum and civility, and where they could reassure themselves through this fairly elevated diction. Like, this is a kind of mock comic, but rather highfalutin style complaint. So they could reassure themselves of their own intellectual status in the kind of thick of the mess of a booming mining town. The kind of poetry on the shelves of the Mechanics Institute Library, we think, provided that kind of respectability, even if people didn't really want to read the poems. I'm going to hand over to Kling.
Okay, so in terms of what else the Mechanics Institute housed, because it obviously wasn't housing just poetry, it housed a wide range of reading materials from technical manuals to newspapers, journals to popular novels. The journals seem to have been particularly kind of popular and fought over, which is kind of interesting to me. In terms of literary works, the tastes of the poet, the patrons of the Mechanics Institute reflect those of the period more generally. So the popular interest in fiction is reflected in a list of books purchased for the Institute during 1866. The names of 13 volumes of science, 20 of poetry, 29 of history, 28 of biography, personal and narrative, and 38 miscellaneous are completely dwarfed by the 307 volumes of novels added to the library over the same period. In 1867, the Bendigo Advertiser noted that recreation was perhaps more important than the other more respectable social functions that the Mechanics Institute might provide. Although novels are apparently of minor importance, the paper observed, they have contributed to the amusement and instruction of a numerous class of readers who, after the fatigues of the day, both bodily and mental, confess their inability to pursue the study of abstruse or scientific subjects, who fully appreciate the value of the works which are to be found in this library. So novels in this account provide the perfect antidote to the hard physical reality of life on the goldfields. The wonderful Bendigo historian Peter Thompson, the authority on the Sandhurst collection, has calculated that in 1881 there were more than 27,000 loans of books categorised as novels, tales and sketches, against just 140 for those in the category poetry and drama. But despite readers' evident reluctance to borrow it, there can be little doubt that poetry was nonetheless regarded as central to the larger civic agenda within which mechanics institutes were established in Victoria. The priority awarded to poetry within the mission of the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute can be seen in its public programs, in which the public recitation of poems, public lectures on poets, and Sandhurst's popular readings all figured prominently. Coverage in the Advertiser in June 1867 gives a sense of what these popular readings, which were miscellaneous in nature but inclined strongly towards poetry and song, looked like, and they sound like they're actually really good fun. So after the President's address, Mr. Cope sang Farewell to the Mountain from Barnett's English opera of The Mountain Sylph and received an encore when he sang There's a Land That Bears a Well-Known Name, both being well-suited to the singer's capacity and voice. In this, the first portion of the program, there was a reading by Dr. Stillwell, a treatise on Akenside on poetry, a comic song by Mr. Santley, the recitation of Byron's Isaacs of Greece by the President, and a duet by Mrs. Ellis and Mr. Towle, and the reading of the celebrated trial scene of Bartle versus Pickwick from Dickens' novel by Mr. Martley. the last name performance being the gem of the evening. So perhaps it's not surprising that an extract from a novel by the extraordinarily popular Dickens was regarded as the gem of the evening. Nonetheless, as you can see, poetic treatises and recitations of poems are included in the schedule of events alongside of comic songs and popular opera. There was something there for everybody. Poetry was definitely part of what was there. The library's own poetry collection was dominated by late 18th and early 19th century English poets, with a few volumes of poets from America. So there's Longfellow, Edgar Allan Poe, Scotland, there's Burns and Scott, William Edmonston, Ayrton, Moore is there from Ireland, Thomas Moore, and several volumes of poems by Dante, Catullus, Homer and the like in translation. By 1870, the collection possessed four volumes of verse by the presiding English poet laureate Tennyson, almost as many as by women. By 1884, there would be eight more volumes by Tennyson and only four more by women. Amongst these volumes came to sit a small number written by colonial authors, and one in particular, Prometheus the Firebringer, exposes the complex intersections of literary culture in the gold fields. So Prometheus the Firebringer was written by an immigrant to the goldfields, Richard Henry, later Henquist Horn, a sometimes friend of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, whose poems also sat in the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute shelves. Horn turns out to just be a real asshole. I mean, sorry to kind of ruin the ending here, but he was a really unpleasant person. Horn had enjoyed minor celebrity as a man of letters in London and arrived in Melbourne in 1852 to try his hand at gold, with an expectation that he could also act as an Australian correspondent for Charles Dickens' Household Words, and that Dickens would remit the earnings from those writings to his wife, who he kind of left back home and abandoned. It's all right, she seemed happy with the arrangement. She was none the worse. Once in Melbourne, in preference to the arduous and chancy labours of a digger, he didn't like working very hard. He instead took up a role in the bureaucratic infrastructure being developed to manage the mining industry. So he was initially a commander of the gold escort between Ballarat and Melbourne. When he left Victoria after 17 years to return to England in 1869, Horn departed, so theatre historian Richard Fotheringham claims, as Australia's most celebrated resident poet. I think he's pushing it a little bit. Other sources suggest that Horn was far from content with the fruits of this celebrity. In his book, Australian Facts and Prospects, published in 1859, Horn saved special contempt for another author, Frank Fowler, who he claimed in print to make £1,000 per year through literary exploits in New South Wales. No such monies came Horn's way in Melbourne or in the adjacent goldfields. And actually, our colleague Tom Ford, who's interested in this kind of colonial era poetry, would probably dispute that claim that you could make that much money in Australia at the time. He says it was actually really hard to make a living as a writer in colonial Australia. And colonial admiration was qualified. As Horn's biographer Anne Blaney puts it, in Australian Facts and Prospects, Horn depicts himself galloping with drawn sword across the Australian bush. While scarcely an English critic was unconvinced, those in Melbourne that knew him, she writes, jeered. Copies of both a colonial edition of Horn's first published book-length poem, Orion, printed in Melbourne in 1854 with a new 8-page preface and subtitled as the first poetic work to appear in the colony, and Prometheus the Firebringer, are listed in Sandhurst's 1884 catalogue. The Mechanics Institute, no doubt partly inspired in their choice by the fact that Horn had been a fellow Goldfields resident. Prometheus the Firebringer is a closet drama in the style of Percy Shelley's Prometheus Unbound and was influenced both by that book and also by the translation of Aeschylus's Prometheus Bound, published by his friend Elizabeth Barrett Browning in 1833. In a dedication that prefaces the poem, Horn describes his habitation in Blue Mountain near Trentham, the region halfway between Bendigo and Melbourne, where he is working in another post in the goldfields bureaucracy. It was, he writes, a place of savage solitude, this Blue Mountain of dark forests, rains and hurricanes, a region nevertheless which may someday suddenly become a wildly populous field of gold miners, without books, without any society, impressed at times with a sense of the precariousness of human life, amidst horse accidents, the fall of massive trees, or the evil chances of dark nights in localities abounding in water holes and deep mining shafts in unexpected places, always left quite unprotected. As in the preface to his colonial edition of his poem Orion, in which he claims to be an exile within an exile in the far bush by the lonely lagoons of Waranga, Horn paints a picture here of his colonial habitation in the sombre colours of Goldfields Gothic. This is a scene of brooding romantic threat in which the dangers extend out from natural disasters, so hurricanes, waterholes, trees, to take in the perils created by the crazy pace of colonial extractivism, erratically placed mine shafts, horse accidents, presumably brought about by the hastily constructed thoroughfares, dysregulated travel and people's general eagerness to get places in a hurry.
Oh, I haven't been following along. Where are we up to? Horn. Okay.
Page 11.
Thank you. Okay. So Horn dedication here romanticises and catastrophises the colonial landscape in which he lived. But the story he tells in the poem Prometheus the Firebringer, which is housed in the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute Library, is fixed in ancient Greece and surrounds. The poem ostensibly returns to the myth of Prometheus, who you might remember if you know this Greek myth, brings the civilizing technology of fire to the primitive humans and is then punished by the jealous gods of Olympus. Horn's Prometheus the Firebringer seems closely engaged with what he sees as being a distinctly colonial problem. In this reading, Horn is Prometheus, colonial society are the mortals, and Horn's poetic genius is the divine fire. And as Prometheus slash Horn prepares to deliver fire slash his poetic genius to the mortals, Hephaestus, who's this sort of god of forging, he's a sort of blacksmith god, so connected to mining, attempts to discourage him. Hephaestus says, "Man, as in the people of the gold fields, is not worth the risk which you incur. Ungrateful is the race by nature, more especially to those who serve the most and sacrifice themselves." Despite having arrived in Melbourne to some fanfare in the newspapers, Horn's literary talents, as sketched out just then, were not remunerated to the extent that he would have liked. Certainly not in the 1850s, when the colony's preoccupation with the weekly delivery of ore overwhelmed pretty much everything else. So Horn's Prometheus might be read as allegorising the relationship between himself and his ungrateful public, but also I think perhaps the relationship between empire, imperial technology and colonised people. The speech of Hephaestus I've just quoted closely echoes some pretty horrendously racist views that Horn put in his 1859 kind of work of journalism, Australian Facts and Prospects, where he claimed that, I just apologise for the racism of this, that the Aborigines of these colonies are by nature resistant to civilisation. Since, quote, the landing of the Europeans, he wrote. And this is actually kind of remarkably perceptive, but not in the way that he thinks it is. No tribe has ever been altered for the better in any material way, and even some of the individual exceptions have returned after a time to their savage life, end quote. Horn went on to accuse Indigenous people of not only lacking the, quote, capacity, but also the, quote, desire to assimilate themselves to the, quote, virtues and refinements of what he called civilization. So in translating the familiar Prometheus story into his new colonial context, Horn also gave his material a newly racist twist. How to bring civilization, in quotation marks, to people who so evidently want nothing to do with what it is you are bringing. We might also note the uncanny coincidence between the narrative presented in Horn's poem and the larger project of the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute, in whose library it was shelved. The Mechanics Institute's activities likewise might seem to conform to a broadly Promethean framework of improvement and civilisation, a project integrated with the violent displacement of Taungurung and Dja Dja Wurrung people. Horne's evident contempt for Indigenous resistance to the civilising gifts of European invaders, the problem as he sees it is that they do not understand what they are being offered, may well have resonated with the colonists of the Victorian goldfields. Horne had represented similar colonists as supposedly without any other weaponry overcoming, quote, small groups of Aborigines of the Goulburn River. Those people, likely Tuggerung people, held, he said, long wooden spears, waddies and bark shields, which raises questions about the implication of a peaceful displacement. But there we are. So Horne's poem might be seen to position its own making, its writing, its creation as an intractable colonial problem. On the one hand, it was committed to the possibility of transplanting into the Victorian goldfields the romantic Prometheism that is seen in works like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, The Modern Prometheus, Percy Shelley's Prometheus Unbound, his friend Elizabeth Barrett Browning's translation of Aeschylus's Prometheus Bound. But that very same project of cultural transplantation is figured in the poem as abortive and miscarried. The locals, it appears, want nothing of the high poetics on offer for all of its glorious classical lineage. Even as Horne rehearsed narratives of the progressive course of colonial civilization, narratives that had been detailed so frequently and influentially in so many colonial poems by the 1860s, he also gave that Advance Australia story a newly downbeat ending. And the miscarriage of colonial civilization he particularises is further aligned not only with Aboriginal powers of resistance and survival, but also, and somewhat more elusively, with the miscarried reception of his own poem and more broadly of Romanticism in the goldfields. You might then see this poem as constituting a kind of performative contradiction in which its own existence stands almost heroically in opposition to the failure of the broader civilising mission it narrates. But you could equally see this as a case of a poem anticipating its own failure amid generalised colonial indifference. For all that indifference, and this is a complicated story about how poetry was received, a squadron of enthusiasts for the civilising potential of high literature turned to Horne as a mascot for colonial improvement. In a letter to the editor of the Bendigo Advertiser in October 1882, the local Baptist minister Henry Robinson, is he known to anyone? I mean, no one's was here in 1882. Not personally, no, no. It's no one's great-grandfather. He quoted a tercet of lines by Horne from Horne's poem Orion before launching into the case against alcohol. So here the kind of, here is this Goldfields poet being used to credential the moral civilising message. Okay, enough about Horne.
Horne's relationship with alcohol, like, I feel like it might have been problematic.
I just feel like I have to mention that Horne, and you all saw his picture, managed to impregnate two teenage women in Melbourne over the course of his decade or so in Victoria. So, that doesn't necessarily tell us how he felt about alcohol, but he wasn't necessarily the most...
Kind of... Actually, yeah, he was a drunk as well.
He might have... Okay, all right.
Everything.
Which is, you know...
You know, yeah.
That sounds fun.
No, but it's kind of ironic, isn't it? Okay. So books on the shelves weren't the only place, of course, that goldfield citizens might encounter poetry. To the contrary, poetry proliferated in the columns of colonial newspapers and other periodicals. And I've got to say, when we started looking at these poems, they're so delightful. They're great. They really give you a snapshot of what was going on at Bendigo at this time. So poetry was available in newspapers and periodicals. It was declaimed on stages and performed in parlours. It jangled in goldfields, music halls, and was printed in colonial songsters and other songbooks. It found its way into advertising copy and the taglines of local merchants and tradesmen. Indeed, the Mechanics Institute catalogue itself forms a bridge between some of these demotic forms that were to be found in the newspapers and those other settings and the more aspirational verses to be found in the slim selection of volumes on the library shelves. Alongside the list of volumes from the library's shelves, the Institute's periodically revised catalogue also contained a range of often highly inventive advertisements for local businesses, some in verse. The best ones are the ones in verse. In the 1869 catalogue, for example, a poem advertising Hyam's Cheapside Auction Mart, purveyors of iron bedsteads, bedding, etc., can be found. The poem begins in a sing-song rhyme before relaxing into a loose ballad meter. And it's not so great that I'll read it for you. You can read it for yourself. I don't think we've got this one. We don't have. Oh, yes. The cheapest house in Bendigo, I would you all observe, is Cheapside House on Pall Mall facing the reserve. There you can buy without a doubt the very best of clothes for ready money and profit small, the motto of Les Beaux. This jingle has many of the hallmarks of Victorian light verse. It's littered with wrenched rhymes like clothes and bows. The final verse rhymes his forte with Temple Court, so his fort, Temple Court, I guess, perhaps reflecting a variant on the pronunciation of fort, but more likely embracing the emerging comic fashion for forced pronunciation, a fashion soon to be made wildly popular in the collaborations of Gilbert and Sullivan. For all that it was composed with the aim of selling more hats, the poem certainly evokes a very vivid picture of colonial Bendigo. For yet more evidence of a broader interest in poetry in colonial Bendigo, we need to look no further than the pages of the Advertiser, a paper that had served the citizens of the town since the early years of the gold rush in 1853. Light, often comic poetry featuring local landscapes, occupations and citizens was a staple feature in the poetry section of the Advertiser. But even in these poems, we'll see a focus on moralising that often seems to be at odds with their comedic aims. In the final part of this paper, we explore poems featured in the Advertiser in 1856 that are notable, and this was just a good way of grouping them, I suppose. They're written about the animals of Bendigo's goldfields. These poems do not have any literary pretensions and can be productively seen as part of the ephemeral culture of Gold Rush, Victoria. They provide a lively insight into the daily life in this thriving town and offer vivid details of life on the diggings. Paddy's poem, The Wanderings and Ponderings of a Well-Bred Horse from the Sydney Side, is prefaced by the following editorial comment setting out its moral agenda. We have no doubt that our readers will peruse with much interest in the following autobiographical sketch of a horse of a moralising and poetical turn of mind, which now exercises his energies in a Bendigo puddling machine. The moral may be found particularly applicable to many human bipeds of vaulting ambition, who after all find their best reward in steady and persevering labour. This prefatorial comment, praising the virtue of hard work over vaulting ambition, echoes the same preoccupation with the need to reform working class social behaviour to conform to middle class notions of propriety that we argue was at play in the formation of the Mechanics Institute. The poem itself continues on this theme, following Paddy as he moves from his early career as a Gold Cup winning thoroughbred to his future occupations as mounted policeman's horse and stock horse before he finally finds himself walking on the puddling machine at the Bendigo diggings. And here are the final three stanzas of the poem. And now I'm a puddling for gold, as you hear, the hungry to feed and the aged to cheer, assist hotels and grog shops to sell nobblers and beer, while I go around and round all the weary long year. Now all you young colts of a well-bred race, if overweighted in training you break down in a race, reflect for a moment and make mine your case, to work hard for a living is no disgrace. For I too am well bred, and when 2 years old, bad luck to the stockyard this boy could hold. But I've had my day, though for £30 sold, satisfied and content to puddle for gold. So this high-bred horse, a horse who despite his golden pedigree speaks in the colonial flash language of grogsops and nobblers, stands in for a type of ideal Sandhurst citizen who, rather than railing against the authorities and protesting government interference in the mines, quietly goes about his day satisfied and content to puddle for gold. The moral of this story is, of course, that fancy breeding, fine looks and speed count for little in the Australian colony, where hard work and the ability to adapt to difficult circumstances are a far more useful characteristic both of man and horse.
I wonder if anyone fancies reciting any of these poems. Has anyone got their reciting voice here with them? No? Okay, well, I'm not going to subject you to my recitations. About a month after the publication of Paddy's poem, It Is Sandhurst's Dogs Rather Than Its Horses who become the topic of the Advertiser's Poets Corner. So on 21st of August 1856, a poem fabulously entitled Doggerels from Huntly by a Dogged Digger to Charles Thatcher Esquire calls for the control of the dog population in the outskirts of the town, places like Epsom and Huntly, which are probably known to you in a different form than they were in 1856. I hope you're enjoying reading that to yourself. I'll just let you linger there for a bit. Perhaps taking inspiration from Paddy's earlier poem, a Dogged Digger's poem solicits a response by Caesar on the 25th of August, 1856. So just later that week, a voice from the dogs is this next poem. Do you mind if I move on to the next one? To the editor of the Bendigo Advertiser. And this response of a digger's dog to the Dogged Digger's objection to the crimes of his kind, in speaking up for the dogs, it neatly sums up the growing disjunction between life in the increasingly orderly streets of Sandhurst and the desperate scrabbling for scraps that characterise life in the goldfields on the town's outskirts. In your poet's corner, this is me putting on a dog's voice from 1950s, in your poet's corner, you've admitted, I'm just speaking roughly, you've admitted a piece of, sorry, it was terrible, a piece of rhyme by no means suited to ease, why am I doing this? To ease the pain we dogs are bearing under the regime of collar wearing, I'm a digger's dog. Whose dog is he that writes so falsely and so free? My master likes me and does swear to chain me up would not be fair. Poor, lonely, striving for a pile, I cheer him up with many a while. Without a friend, without a wife, he else would lead a joyless life. I've seen him in the whipstick scrub with not enough to get a scrub. No beef for him, no paunch for me, our hope a grim uncertainty, etc., etc., etc. Speaking up for the dogs, but also for the diggers. This poem depicts two competing classes of Sandhurst citizen, the digger who inhabits the egalitarian world of the goldfields, where men appreciate the companionship and support of their dogs, and each day is a hard fight with poverty, and then the law-abiding townsman who understands that dogs need to be controlled and counted in order to become fit candidates for registration. Perhaps a bit of a metaphor there for the ordering of mining and miners. All of these poems are preoccupied with articulating the attributes and values of the ideal citizen of Bendigo. They each proclaim a stake in the making of the new colonial town. It's no surprise that the values that they endorse, hard work, hard scrabble, enterprise on the one hand, and regulation and social control on the other, became central to the way in which the town of Bendigo was to go about carving a space for itself in the new British colony of Victoria. Historian Sarah Coman has explored the role of Victorian goldfields, Mechanics Institutes, in fostering what she calls a literary sociability that, quote, lent respectability to the economic substrate of the town, that is gold. Mechanics Institutes can be understood as one of the key strategies employed by colonial authorities to temper and discipline the motley, unruly society that had been brought suddenly into being by the gold rush. Looking back in a lecture delivered to the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute and then self-published in 1860, John McCartney recalled, quote, a village of shanties, calico largely predominating, the streets unformed, and in winter, one sea of mud. Historian James Bellich, meanwhile, has described the diggings as the last great manifestation of what he calls crew culture, the rough and ready matrix of social conventions that shaped the life of the disposable, mobile male workforce of empire. In June 1853, the Anti-Gold Licence Association was formed in Sandhurst, objecting to the fee structure imposed on miners and demanding the removal of government troops commissioned to enforce it. Red ribbon protests and shows of strength shortly followed. Troops from the 40th Regiment sent out to Victoria from Britain on Governor La Trobe's request in 1852, who were quartered at Government Camp, now Rosalind Park, were reinforced in consequence of some threatened disturbances. But military force alone seemed incapable of securing social order and subordination. We see the formation of institutions like the Mechanics Institute in this context, but it's also the context in which we see the uptake of poetry in 19th century Bendigo, both through its subject matter and its associations, It is used, we suggest, to promote a kind of social order and decorum. And if we can just take you from the village of shanties, the calico largely predominating, to this scene in the Mechanics Institute, you can see how quickly the transformation occurred. That's us, really.
So we have some time for questions. It's also beautifully timed. So we have about 10 minutes now where we can field some questions both in the room, and also Geordie will keep an eye on Zoom if there's any questions online as well. I'll open it up to the floor, really.
I have one.
Oh, go on.
The horse poem about the horse in the puddler. What year was that one? Again, 1856?
Yeah.
56, was it?
Yeah.
Do you think it had any of those kinds of... I know there's often a difference between the different Bendigo newspapers publishing different things for different classes. So the Addie would often speak down rather than sort of regard the diggers equally. But do you think there was any of that kind of speaking down in the poetry of the time directly at the diggers?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I don't know. It doesn't. I'd sort of open that one up to the floor, really. I think those poems are kind of representative of what's there, or at least what was there in the year that we looked at. And I don't know. They don't seem to be too condescending. What are your thoughts, Alexis?
I don't think they're. I think they are. They're written by locals, who are perhaps miners or perhaps part of the apparatus around mining. And they're in kind of popular forms. So you might read that as being condescending. Why aren't they aspiring to higher poetic forms? But maybe they couldn't aspire to higher poetic forms. Or maybe they just liked the kind of ballad form, which had a pretty august heritage by this point as well. So I think that's an excellent question, but I find it a bit hard to put my finger on the answer to that.
You'd have to read all of them.
Yeah, that's
right. You would, and it would be different for the different ones. But I think that point about the kind of the editorial tone of the different newspapers is a really good one.
Yeah, I mean, the editorial is moralising for sure. Yeah, I mean, that's talking down.
Mm-mm.
And that is a weird poem, the horse poem. I sort of wanted it to end differently than it does. Like, because obviously you could see the horse as a metaphor for like a Bendigonian citizen, right? They've ended up in Bendigo after trying their luck at other things. Mm. But,
be like the horse, be content with your lot.
Even if the lot is pretty horrible. I mean, who would want to be a puddling horse walking in a circle all day? Not me.
Any other questions here for now? I've got one here, I think. Yeah. Oh, is there an index of the poems?
So in the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute context, there are catalogues, and there are catalogues from different years, so we can see the volumes of poetry slowly growing, and we can see a few changes there.
That sounds like a citizen project. Trove is pretty freely available. You could get access to Trove through here.
Yeah.
Anyone who'd like to catalogue the poems in the Addy
in
the 1850s, we would love to see that research done. We could do a lot with that.
Yeah, I don't know who asked that question and maybe how much we're teaching our grandmother how to suck eggs in our answer, but Trove, the National Library of Australia's digitisation of 19th century newspapers, means that you could search, for example, for the word poetry in the Bendigo Advertiser, and you could bring up every time that word occurred, and it wouldn't necessarily capture everything, but you would get a lot that way, and then you could start to create a bit of an index.
I mean, I've got an index for 1858, but that took a while.
Yeah, you've done your own personal.
I did my own personal
research.
Just for 1858?
Yeah. 1856.
1856. How big is that index just for that one year?
It's not huge. I mean, there was poetry regularly, but it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't central.
Yeah, and there are a few Bendigo newspapers from that era, like the Sandhurst Bee, the Bee of Sandhurst.
Oh yeah,
which doesn't seem to have been. Doesn't certainly the National Library doesn't.
We've got it on microfilm here. If you'd like to have a look,
that's so exciting. Wow, this might be the only surviving...
The State Library will have it too.
Does it?
I would be surprised if they don't.
don't know if they do.
If they do, it may not be publicly accessible. It's just in the filing cabinet upstairs. You can go and have a look at it.
What a thrill.
Yeah. Someone else also said the editorial for the Bendigo Advertiser this week is, I think, a poem about an echidna. So the tradition continues. So.
Lives on.
Yeah.
Fantastic. The whole of the project, animals and poetry. And the Bendigo Advertiser.
I'm going to move just in case for people online so they can hear me ask this very ill-formed and ill-thought-out question. I was really struck by the way in which you talked about poetry and so many rich sort of examples that you had and the way when you talked about the Mechanics Institute and just the sheer number of people that were borrowing novels versus the poetry. And I was wondering if you could just say a bit more about this, I guess, the distinction between the sort of high literary poetry and then the sort of doggerel verse, because it reminded me of some of the poems that I see in like trade union journals. And I was, I had never really thought about poetry as a way for people to sort of, it is a way of making sense and the rhyming is a very kind of containing thing, isn't it? It is that. So, could you say a little bit more about that?
This is my total bag. Like, this is my thing.
We're so glad you asked him.
He gave me a platinum, a literal. No, I mean, poetry persists in all manner of forms throughout, particularly the 18th and 19th century, I guess, as both popular, in both popular forms written by everyday people. And to me, those poems are often the most interesting because they tell you things that are hard to access otherwise. Like there's a lot of detail, for example, in that Funny Horse poem that I think is really evocative, and I don't know where else you'd kind of find that detail. And so I think poetry was accessible to everyday people, although that's not how it might have been presented at the Mechanics Institute. But clearly everyday people too were interested in hearing about poetry. Like they were going to, there was a really popular reading done here. I don't know if it was at the Mechanics Institute, but there were also the Athenaeum and I think the Temperance Hall also did lectures. So lectures were popular. And some of the most popular ones were on poets. Mm. So Byron was, which is kind of interesting. Byron was also always very popular. People would come out to listen to people talk about Byron. Mm. There was just it was as much popular as it was high cultural.
A sense of the reception of the sort of high cultural poets of a generation or two earlier is that they were celebrated as poets, as celebrities, as people who'd led really interesting lives, more than their poetry was, in a way. So,
or as symbols of revolution. So Shelley is obviously popular, not only because he was attractive and died young and there's a whole mythology around him, but also because he was revolutionary. Mm. And I think that there was a sort of, an interest in that kind of thinking as well. And so, Byron's sexy, we can see why they might have liked Byron.
That's right. So there's a lot of biographies in the Mechanics Institute archive and they were being borrowed quite a lot. And we see biographies of literary figures proliferating through the 70s and 80s, whereas the collection of poetry.
1870s and
80s. 1870s and 80s, yeah. Yeah, sorry. The 70s. But the poetry itself in the Mechanics Institute doesn't grow at the same rate. So that is that distinction is really important that you've drawn out there.
Yeah.
Anyone have any questions here? Yeah.
I was just really wondering about what is the Mechanics Institute? And there are obviously many of them established, and they're obviously established for possibly multiple purposes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
So that's a great question. And in fact, the kind of gazetted purpose of the Institute ended up being displaced by its function as a library. So it was initially established as a place of education and recreation for mechanics, meaning people who work with their hands, to improve society through that class of people, the betterment of that class of people. There was a plan initially for a series of basically workshops, lectures, things probably a bit like this even, but rapidly its function as a borrowing library or lending library took over. But we still see things like the existence of the chess room from that member suggestion book. So there was still this sort of social space there. It was a predominantly male space, although at some point members, wives and juvenile members of the family could have all the benefits of membership except voting, so says the regulations. So became a little bit more diverse at that point. Does that answer your question, sort of?
So they were explicitly kind of civilizing, part of a civilizing mission. And in Britain, they were part of lower class, working class reform. And in Australia, they played the kind of really interesting, complicated role that we kind of sketch out here. Mm. So that kind of working class reform works out in a different way in the Australian context. Yeah.
But and then the Sandhurst Mechanics Institute became the Bendigo School of Mines, moved into the same building in the 70s, 1870s.
The Eagle Hawk Mechanics Institute is still where the library is today. The Eagle Hawk Library is in the same building. And a lot of our other branches up in the Loddonshire are still in Mechanics Institute buildings.
Yes.
In other towns, of course, they serve a variety of purposes now, but they're kind of, civic buildings that have and continue often to be used for public events.
Thanks so much, Alexis and Claire. I think you're going to be staying in Bendigo tonight, so people can probably grab you for a question if they haven't had a chance to ask. So thanks so much for coming out, as you say, on a winter night, and thanks to those on Zoom as well.
Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to Literary La Trobe, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Jajawarong and Tuggerong country. You can find out more about this podcast and other La Trobe podcasts on the La Trobe University website.